Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Now, the New Hampshire bill is a prime example of what Harvard historian Carolyn Light calls the do-it-yourself security citizenship movement, a movement to take self-defense, sometimes lethal self-defense, into our own hands. She's written a book about the subject called Stand Your Ground, The History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Defense, and she joins us now in the studio. And Carolyn Light, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
I'd love it if you could just give me a quick definition of what is do-it-yourself security citizenship.
Essentially, it's the idea that you must take your own safety into your own hands because nobody else is going to do it for you. Yeah. Not the government, not law enforcement, nobody but you. And it is also based on the idea that you must kill or be killed. Be prepared to take someone else's life because you are always under threat. So it's based on a lot of anxiety and fear.
Yeah, and very much sort of at the heart of this debate about guns and gun ownership and gun rights, which we were just talking with Chief Brackett about. I'd love to start with some history because this is, among other things, a history book. Bring us back to English common law, which was the law of the land, and what it said about this kind of lethal self-defense.
So I try to go back as far as I can, back to before there was a United States. And there was a legal doctrine about the duty to retreat. Human life was valued to the point that if you were under attack from someone, you were obligated to retreat to the wall behind your back before you met force with force. Hmm. This was encoded into English common law. You weren't allowed to fight back lethally. The one exception to that was known as the Castle Doctrine. This originates in the early 1600s in England, again, with the idea that a man's house is his castle. In other words, if someone attacked you in your house, you could fight back with lethal force. That was the one exception.
Right. But of course, that means this right of lethal self-defense is connected to home ownership. And of course, there weren't a lot of folks with a home who owned a home, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was from the get-go a selective kind of self-defense ideology. It was based on property ownership and citizenship, full citizenship, which was absolutely all about race and gender and class. There were certain people who enjoyed the full rights, privileges, and protections of full citizenship, and those were a minority of the population.
Really interesting. So your book is called Stand Your Ground, The History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Defense, and so we've moved from that idea of it being sort of understood that you must and should retreat if you can to this idea of stand your ground, right?
Right, absolutely.
So what gave rise to this movement in America?
Oh, my. So it's a long story, but I try to go back to the very beginning of the United States and the ideas that, for instance, European-descended men, settler colonialism, the idea that there was a particular right imbued in European masculinity to spread civilization from sea to shining sea, the idea of manifest destiny, and the way in which that was incommensurable with this idea that men should retreat in the face of danger. So the Castle Doctrine gradually expanded beyond the boundaries of the private home when you get into what would become the United States. Particularly, I spent a lot of time talking about the post-Civil War era Reconstruction as African Americans are at least on the surface given freedom, given citizenship, and as men are enfranchised with the 15th Amendment, we start to see pushback in the form of the expansion of the Castle Doctrine for white men in particular in the wake of Reconstruction. So this trend continues up to the point where we are right now, to make a long story short, where in approximately 33 states, we have different versions of these stand your ground laws that on the surface endow anyone with the right to fight back with lethal self-defense wherever
now, why
they
on the,
can be.
Why on the surface? Why on the surface? You're
why
suggesting that not everybody is imbued
no.
with that same right.
No, our laws are not colorblind the way they are adjudicated. If you look on the surface of the law, it sounds like it's race and gender blind. Mm-hmm. Any man, woman, whoever who is threatened can fight back with lethal self-defense. But if you look at the way the laws are adjudicated in those states with the stand your ground law, you can see that they very much favor white men who are fighting against or fighting back against claiming self-defense against minority people, particularly men, but not only.
A case in point, for example, it's been 5 years since the shooting death of Trevon Martin, 17
yes.
years old in Florida, by George Zimmerman, who claimed self-defense. He was found not guilty. That's a real example of that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, essentially, stand your ground is a selective license to kill for people who can claim that they were fighting back for fear of their own, you know, danger or a threat of on their life. But what it amounts to really is this notion of kill or be killed for specific kinds of so-called law-abiding citizens, but not for others.
There's something else you write in here that's really intriguing. You write that defensively armed citizen has become, in some quarters, the paragon of patriotism,
yes.
unquote, which suggests that self-defense has gone from a right to a duty almost.
Absolutely. Yeah. In many quarters, and I would say gun rights activists epitomize this ideology that to be a good citizen, you need to be an armed citizen. But as we've seen with so many people like Philando Castile this summer, there are certain kinds of people, and in his case, a black man who was legally carrying a firearm was seen as a criminal threat by mm-hmm. law enforcement. So that's the ideal. The ideal is that to be a good citizen, you must be armed and prepared to fight back for your life. In reality, however, it's a very selectively upheld right.
Today, in the U.S., gun rights inevitably seem linked to partisan politics. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a cause. Gun rights are a cause for many conservative Republicans. I mean, these are generalizations, but it's as far as generalizations go, it's a pretty good one for liberal Democrats. They generally favor tighter gun regulations. Was this always so?
It was not. And actually, it's really complicated. The partisan politics around do-it-yourself security citizenship are really complicated. I try in my book to signal just how complicated, to give you a really interesting exception to the sort of partisan idea that gun rights are the province of a more conservative leaning people. There's an organization that originated in 2015 called the Black Women's Defense League in Dallas. And they are very much about progressively protecting African-American women from both white supremacy, which is still very pervasive in our nation, and patriarchy and misogynist violence. These are women who exist at that intersection and who are fighting back by arming themselves and protecting themselves. So I want to balance the way we're thinking about this by looking at the nuance involved in do-it-yourself security citizenship. It isn't just gun rights. It isn't just the NRA. There are also people. The Pink Pistols are another good example. LGBTQ identified folks who are investing time and energy in learning how to protect themselves, not just with guns, but in other ways too. Being aware of their surroundings, being aware of the existence of hate crimes, people who are homophobic and violently so, particularly right here and now. So, yes, there's a partisan element to it, but I don't want to simplify it because there certainly are other folks who are, I would say, progressive-minded folks who are invested in arming themselves. I do want to say, however, the law does not come down on their side. Marissa Alexander, recently released from house arrest, a black woman who defended herself with a warning shot, ended up serving time in jail. She, in her case, prosecution couldn't imagine that she was reasonably afraid for her safety.
I'm curious, you know, looking at your title, America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense, it is such a uniquely American phenomenon. But let me ask you that. Is it? Are there other countries that have such a love affair with this idea of lethal self-defense?
I don't think there's any that compare to the United States. When you look at our statistics, the number of guns we have in this nation have surpassed the number of human beings in the nation. The number of mass violent shootings, way more than any other comparable nation. We are absolutely unique in the sense of seeing lethal self-defense as a right, and also in the proliferation of guns as a solution to security threats.
In literally the sort of 20 seconds or so we have left, what do you hope people will take away by understanding this history? Because this is such an issue that is imbued with such fraught debate. What do you hope people take away?
I want them to think about the uncomfortable past that has paved the way to where we are now, and to think really critically, self-critically, about our investment in lethal self-defense.
That's Carolyn Light. She's the director of the Undergraduate Studies in Studies of Women at Harvard, and her new book is called Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Defense. Carolyn Light, thank you so much. What a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.